Nicholas drifted by them. Peering through the mists, he glimpsed a broken spire, a headless hero, an ancient tree torn from the ground and upended, its huge roots twisting through the roof and windows of a broken dome. Why does all of this seem so familiar? Straight on, a tilted stairway of pale marble rose up out of the dark water in a graceful spiral, ending abruptly 10 feet above their heads. No, thought Tyrion, that is not possible. Ahead, Limor's voice was shivery. A light! All of them looked. All of them saw it. Kingfisher, said Griff. Her, or some other like her. But he drew his sword again. No one said a word. The shy maid moved with the current. Her sail had not been raised since she first entered the Sorrows. She had no way to move but with the river. Duck stood squinting, clutching his pole with both hands. After a time, even Yandri stopped pushing. Every eye was on the distant light. As they grew closer, it turned into 2 lights, then 3. "The Bridge of Dream," said Tyrion. "Inconceivable," said Holden Halfmaester. "We've left the bridge behind. Rivers only run one way." "Mother Rowan runs how she will," murmured Yandri. "Seven save us," said L'Amour. Up ahead, the stone men on the span began to wail. A few were pointing down at them. "Alden, get the prince below," commanded Griff. It was too late. The current had them in its teeth. They drifted inexorably toward the bridge. Yandri stabbed out with his pole to keep them from smashing into a pier. The thrust shoved them sideways through a curtain of pale grey moss. Tyrion felt tendrils brush against his face, soft as a whore's fingers. Then there was a crash behind him, and the deck tilted so suddenly that he almost lost his feet and went pitching over the side. A stone man crashed down into the boat. He landed on the cabin roof so heavily that the shy maid seemed to rock, and roared a word down at them in a tongue that Tyrion did not know. A second stone man followed, landing back beside the tiller. The weathered planks splintered beneath the impact, and Ysilla let out a shriek. Duck was closest to her. The big man did not waste time reaching for his sword. Instead, he swung his pole, slamming it into the stone man's chest and knocking him off the boat into the river, where he sank at once without a sound. Griff was on the second man the instant he shambled down off the cabin roof. With a sword in his right hand and a torch in his left, he drove the creature backwards. As the current swept the shy maid beneath the bridge, their shifting shadows danced upon the mossy walls. When the stone man moved aft, Duck blocked his way, pole in hand. When he went forward, Holden Halfmaester waved a second torch at him and drove him back. He had no choice but to come straight at Griff. The captain slid aside, his blade flashing. A spark flew where the steel bit into the stone man's calcified grey flesh, but his arm tumbled to the deck all the same. Griff kicked the limb aside. Yandri and Duck had come up with their poles. Together they forced the creature over the side and into the black waters of the Rhoyn. By then the shy maid had drifted out from under the broken bridge. "Did we get them all?" asked Duck. "How many jumped?" 2, said Tyrion, shivering. 3, said Holden, behind you! The dwarf turned, and there he stood. The leap had shattered one of his legs, and a jagged piece of pale bone jutted out through the rotted cloth of his breeches and the grey meat beneath. The broken bone was speckled with brown blood, but still he lurched forward, reaching for young Griff. His hand was grey and stiff, but blood oozed between his knuckles as he tried to close his fingers to grasp. The boy stood staring, as still as if he too were made of stone. His hand was on his sword hilt, but he seemed to have forgotten why. Tyrion kicked the lad's leg out from under him and leapt over him when he fell, thrusting his torch into the stone man's face to send him stumbling backwards on his shattered leg, flailing at the flames with stiff grey hands. The dwarf waddled after him, slashing with the torch, jabbing it at the stone man's eyes. A little further, back, one more step, another. They were at the edge of the deck when the creature rushed him, grabbed the torch, and ripped it from his hands. Bugger me, thought Tyrion. The stone man flung the torch away. There was a soft hiss as the black waters quenched the flames. The stone man howled. He'd been a summer islander before. His jaw and half his cheek had turned to stone, but his skin was black as midnight where it was not grey. Where he had grasped the torch, his skin had cracked and split. Blood was seeping from his knuckles, though he did not seem to feel it. That was some small mercy, Tyrion supposed. Though mortal, Greyscale was supposedly not painful. "Stand aside!" someone shouted, far away, and another voice said, "The prince! Protect the boy!" The stone man staggered forward, his hands outstretched and grasping. Tyrion drove a shoulder into him. It felt like slamming into a castle wall, but this castle stood upon a shattered leg. The stone man went over backwards, grabbing hold of Tyrion as he fell. They hit the river with a towering splash, and Mother Rhoyne swallowed up the two of them. The sudden cold hit Tyrion like a hammer. As he sank, he felt a stone hand fumbling at his face. Another closed around his arm, dragging him down into darkness. Blind, his nose full of river, choking, sinking, he kicked and twisted and fought to pry the clutching fingers off his arm. But the stone fingers were unyielding. Air bubbled from his lips. The world was black and growing blacker. He could not breathe. There are worse ways to die than drowning. And if truth be told, he had perished long ago, back in King's Landing. It was only his revenant who remained, the small, vengeful ghost, who throttled Shay and put a crossbow bolt through the great Lord Tywin's bowels. No man would mourn the thing that he'd become. "I'll haunt the Seven Kingdoms," he thought, sinking deeper. "They would not love me living, so let them dread me dead." When he opened his mouth to curse them all, black water filled his lungs, and the dark closed in around him. Davos. "His lordship will hear you now, smuggler." The knight wore silver armour, his greaves and gauntlet inlaid with niello to suggest flowing fronds of seaweed. The helm beneath his arm was the head of a Merling king, with a crown of mother-of-pearl and a jutting beard of jet and jade. His own beard was as grey as the winter sea. Davos rose. "May I know your name, sir?" "Sir Marlon Manderley." He was a head taller than Davos, and 3 stone heavier, with slate-grey eyes and a haughty way of speaking. "I have the honour to be Lord Wyman's cousin and commander of his garrison. Follow me." Davos had come to White Harbour as an envoy, but they had made him a captive. His chambers were large, airy, and handsomely furnished, but there were guards outside his doors. From his window he could see the streets of White Harbour beyond the castle walls, but he was not allowed to walk them. He could see the harbour, too, and had watched Merry Midwife make her way down the Firth. Casso Mogat had waited 4 days instead of 3 before departing. Another fortnight had passed since then. Lord Manderley's household guard wore cloaks of blue-green wool and carried silver tridents in place of common spears. One went before him, one behind, and one to either side. They walked past the faded banners, broken shields, and rusted swords of 100 ancient victories, and a score of wooden figures, cracked and worm-riddled, that could only have adorned the prows of ships. 2 marble mermen flanked his lordship's court, fish-foot's smaller cousins. As the guards threw open the doors, a herald slammed the butt of his staff against an old plank floor. "Sir Davis of House Seaworth," he called in a ringing voice. As many times as he had visited White Harbour, Davis had never set foot inside the new castle, much less the Merman's Court. Its walls and floor and ceiling were made of wooden planks, notched cunningly together and decorated with all the creatures of the sea. As they approached the dais, Davis trod on painted crabs and clams and starfish, half hidden amongst twisting black fronds of seaweed and the bones of drowned sailors. On the walls to either side, pale sharks prowled painted blue-green depths, whilst eels and octopods slithered amongst rocks and sunken ships. Shoals of herring and great codfish swam between the tall arched windows. Higher up, near where the old fishing nets drooped down from the rafters, the surface of the sea had been depicted. To his right, a war galley stroked serene against the rising sun. To his left, a battered old cog raced before a storm, her sails in rags. Behind the dais, a kraken and grey leviathan were locked in battle beneath the painted waves. Davis had hoped to speak with Wyman Manderley alone, but he found a crowded court. Along the walls, the women outnumbered the men by 5 to 1. What few males he did see had long grey beards or looked too young to shave. There were septons as well, and holy sisters in white robes and grey. Near the top of the hall stood a dozen men in the blue and silver grey of House Frey. Their faces had a likeness a blind man could have seen. Several wore the badge of the twins, 2 towers connected by a bridge. Davis had learned to read men's faces long before Maester Pylus had taught him to read words on paper. "These Freys would gladly see me dead," he realized at a glance. Nor did he find any welcome in the pale blue eyes of Wyman Manderley. His lordship's cushioned throne was wide enough to accommodate 3 men of common girth, yet Manderley threatened to overflow it. His lordship sagged into his seat. His shoulders slumped, his legs splayed, his hands resting on the arms of his throne, as if the weight of them were too much to bear. "Guards be good," thought Davis, when he saw Lord Wyman's face. "This man looks half a corpse." His skin was pallid, with an undertone of grey. "Kings and corpses always draw attendance," the old saying went. So it was with Manderley. Left of the high seat stood a maester, nigh as fat as the lord he served, a rosy-cheeked man with thick lips and a head of golden curls. Sir Marlon claimed the place of honour at his lordship's right hand. On a cushioned stool at his feet perched a plump pink lady. Behind Lord Wyman stood 2 younger women, sisters by the look of them. The elder wore her brown hair bound in a long braid. The younger, no more than 15, had an even longer braid, dyed a garish green. None chose to honour Davis with a name. The maester was the first to speak. "You stand before Wyman Manderley, Lord of White Harbour, and Warden of the White Knife, Shield of the Faith, Defender of the Dispossessed, Lord Marshal of the Mander, a Knight of the Order of the Green Hand," he said. "In the Merman's Court, it is customary for vassals and petitioners to kneel." The Onion Knight would have bent his knee, but a king's hand could not. To do so would suggest that the king he served was less than this fat lord. "I have not come as a petitioner," Davis replied. "I have a string of titles, too. Lord of the Rainwood, Admiral of the Narrow Sea, Hand of the King." The plump woman on the stool rolled her eyes.
"An admiral without ships? A hand without fingers, in service to a king without a throne? Is this a knight who comes before us, or the answer to a child's riddle?"
"He is a messenger, good daughter," Lord Wyman said, "an onion of ill omen. Stannis did not like the answer his ravens brought him, so he sent this smuggler." He squinted at Davis through eyes half buried in rolls of fat. You have visited our city before, I think, taking coin from our pockets and food off our table. How much did you steal from me, I wonder? Not enough that you ever missed a meal. I paid for my smuggling at Storm's End, my lord.
Davis pulled off his glove and held up his left hand with his four shortened fingers.
4 fingertips for a lifetime's worth of theft, said the woman on the stool.
Her hair was yellow, her face round and pink and fleshy.
You got off cheaply, Onion Knight.
Davis did not deny it.
If it please, my lord, I would request a privy audience.
It did not please the lord.
I keep no secrets from my kin, nor from my leal lords and knights. Good friends all. My lord, said Davis, I would not want my words to be heard by his grace's enemies, or by your lordship's. Stannis may have enemies in this hall. I do not. Not even the men who slew your son, Davis pointed. These Freys were amongst his hosts at the Red Wedding.
One of the Freys stepped forward, a knight long and lean of limb, clean-shaven, but for a grey moustache as thin as a mere stiletto. The Red Wedding was the young wolf's work. He changed into a beast before our eyes and tore out the throat of my cousin Jingle Bell, a harmless simpleton. He would have slain my lord father, too, if Sir Wendell had not put himself in the way. Lord Wyman blinked back tears.
Wendell was always a brave boy. I was not surprised to learn he died a hero.
The enormity of the lie made Davis gasp.
Is it your claim that Robb Stark killed Wendell Manderly?
He asked the Frey.
And many more. Mine own son Titus was amongst them, and my daughter's husband. When Stark changed into a wolf, his Northmen did the same. The mark of the beast was on them all. Wags birth other wags with a bite. It's well known. It was all my brothers and I could do to put them down before they slew us all.
The man was smirking as he told the tale. Davis wanted to peel his lips off with a knife.
Sir, may I have your name?
Sir Jared of House Frey.
Jared of House Frey? Oh, I name you liar.
Sir Jared seemed amused. Some men cry when slicing onions, but I've never had that weakness. Steel whispered against leather as he drew his sword.
If you are indeed a knight, sir, defend that slander with your body.
Lord Wyman's eyes fluttered open.
I'll have no bloodshed in the Merman's court. Put up your steel, Sir Jared, else I must ask you to leave my presence.
Sir Jared sheathed his sword.
Beneath your lordship's roof, your lordship's word is law, but I shall want a reckoning with this onion lord before he leaves this city.
Blood!
Howled the woman on the stool.
That's what this ill onion wants of us, my lord. See how he stirs up trouble. Send him away, I beg you. He wants the blood of your people, the blood of your brave sons. Send him away. Should the queen hear that she gave audience to this traitor, she may question our own loyalty. She might, she could, she...
It will not come to that, good daughter,
Lord Wyman said.
The Iron Throne shall have no cause to doubt us.
Davis misliked the sound of that, but he had not come all this way to hold his tongue.
The boy on the Iron Throne is a usurper, he said, and I am no traitor, but the hand of Stannis Baratheon, the first of his name, the true-born king of Westeros.
The fat maester cleared his throat.
Stannis Baratheon was brother to our late King Robert. May their father judge him justly. Tommen is the issue of Robert's body. The laws of succession are clear in such a case. A son must come before a brother.
Maester Theermore speaks truly, said Lord Wyman. He is wise in all such matters, and has always given me good counsel.
A true-born son comes before a brother, Davis agreed. But Tommen called Baratheon is bastard-born.
as his brother Joffrey was before him. They were sired by the Kingslayer, in defiance of all the laws of gods and men.
Another of the Freys spoke up.
He speaks treason with his own lips, my lord. Stannis took his thieving fingers. You should take his lying tongue.
Take his head, rather, suggested Sir Gareth, or let him meet me on the field of honour.
What would a Frey know of honour?
Davos threw back. Four of the Freys started forward, until Lord Wyman halted them with an upraised hand.
Step back, my friends. I will hear him out before I deal with him.
Can you offer any proof of this incest, sir?
Maester Theomore asked, folding his soft hands atop his belly.
Edric Storm, thought Davos, but I sent him far away across the narrow sea to keep him safe from Melisandre's fires. You have the word of Stannis Baratheon that all I've said is true.
Words are wind, said the young woman behind Lord Wyman's high seat,
the handsome one with the long brown braid.
And men will lie to get their way, as any maid could tell you.
Proof requires more than some lord's unsupported word, declared Maester Theomore. Stannis Baratheon would not be the first man who ever lied to win a throne.
The pink woman pointed a plump finger down at Davos.
We want no part of any treason, you. We are good people in White Harbour, lawful, loyal people. Pour no more poison in our ears, or my good father will send you to the wolf's den.
How have I offended this one?
Might I have the honour of my lady's name?
The pink woman gave an angry sniff and let the maester answer.
The Lady Leone is wife to Lord Wyman's son, Sir Willis, presently a captive of the Lannisters.
Oh, she speaks from fear.
If White Harbour should declare for Stannis, her husband would answer with his life.
How can I ask Lord Wyman to condemn his son to death? What would I do in his place if Devon were a hostage?
My lord, said Davos, I pray no harm will come to your son, or to any man of White Harbour.
Another lie, said Lady Leona from her stool.
Davos thought it best to ignore her.
When Robb Stark took up arms against the bastard Joffrey called Baratheon, White Harbour marched with him. Lord Stark has fallen, but his war goes on.
Robb Stark was my liege lord, said Lord Wyman. Who is this man, Stannis? Why does he trouble us?
He never felt the need to journey north before, as best I can recall, yet he turns up now, a beaten cur with his helm in his hand, begging for alms.
He came to save the realm, my lord, Davos insisted.
To defend your lands against the Ironborn and the Wildlings.
Next to the high seat, Sir Marlon Manderley gave a snort of disdain.
It has been centuries since White Harbour has seen any wildlings, and the Iron Men have never troubled this coast.
Does Lord Stannis propose to defend us from snarks and dragons, too?
Laughter swept the merman's court, but at Lord Wyman's feet, Lady Leona began to sob.
Iron Men from the Isles, wildlings from beyond the wall, now this traitor lord with his outlaws, rebels and sorcerers.
She pointed a finger at Davos.
We have heard of your red witch. Oh, yes, she would turn us against the Seven to bow before a fire demon.
Davos had no love for the Red Priestess, but he dare not let Lady Leona go unanswered.
Lady Melisandre is a priestess of the Red God. Queen Selyse has adopted her faith along with many others, but more of his gracious followers still worship the Seven. Myself among them.
He prayed no one would ask him to explain about the Sept at Dragonstone or the Godswood at Storm's End.
If they ask, I must needs tell them. Stannis would not have me lie.
The Seven defend White Harbour, Lady Leona declared. We do not fear your Red Queen or her God. Let her send what spell she will. The prayers of godly men will shield us against evil.
Indeed,
Lord Wyman gave Lady Leona a pat on the shoulder. "Lord Davis, if you are Lord, I know what your so-called king would have of me. Steel and silver and a bended knee." He shifted his weight to lean upon an elbow. "Before he was slain, Lord Tywin offered White Harbour full pardon for our support of the young wolf. He promised that my son would be returned to me once I paid a ransom of 3,000 dragons and proved my loyalty beyond a doubt. Roose Bolton, who is named our Warden of the North, requires that I give up my claim to Lord Hornwood's lands and castles, but swears my other holdings shall remain untouched. Walder Frey, his good father, offers one of his daughters to be my wife, and husbands for my son's daughters here behind me. These terms seem generous to me, a good basis for a fair and lasting peace. You would have me spurn them? So I ask you, Onion Knight, what does Lord Stannis offer me in return for my allegiance? War and woe and the screams of burning men, Davos might have said. The chance to do your duty, he replied instead. That was the answer Stannis would have given Wyman Manderley. The Anne should speak with a king's voice. Lord Wyman sagged back in his chair. Duty! I see. White Harbour is not strong enough to stand alone. You need his grace as much as he needs you. Together you can defeat your common enemies. My lord, said Sir Marlon, in his ornate silver armour, will you permit me to ask a few questions of Lord Davis?
As you wish, cousin.
Lord Wyman closed his eyes. Sir Marlon turned to Davis. How many northern lords have declared for Stannis? Tell us that.
Arnulf Carstark has vowed to join his grace.
Arnulf is no true lord, only a castellan. What castles does Lord Stannis hold at present, pray?
His grace has taken the Night Fort for his seat. In the south he holds Storm's End and Dragonstone.
Maester Theomore cleared his throat. Only for the nonce, Storm's End and Dragonstone are lightly held and must soon fall, and the Night Fort is a haunted ruin, a drear and dreadful place.
Sir Marlon went on. How many men can Stannis put into the field? Can you tell us that? How many knights ride with him? How many bowmen? How many free riders? How many men-at-arms?
Too few, Davis knew. Stannis had come north with no more than 1,500 men, but if he told them that, his mission here was doomed. He fumbled for words and found none.
Your silence is all the answer I require, sir. Your king brings us only enemies.
Sir Marlon turned to his lord cousin.
Your lordship asked the Onion Knight what Stannis offers us. Let me answer. He offers us defeat and death. He would have you mount a horse of air and give battle with a sword of wind.
The fat lord opened his eyes slowly, as if the effort were almost too much for him.
My cousin cuts to the bone as ever. Do you have any more to say to me, Onion Knight, or can we put an end to this mummer's farce? I grow weary of your face.
Davos felt a stab of despair.
His grace should have sent another man, a lord or knight or maester, someone who could speak for him without tripping on his own tongue. Death, he heard himself say. There will be death, i.e. your lordship lost a son at the Red Wedding. I lost four upon the Black Water. And why? Because the Lannisters stole the throne. Go to King's Landing and look on Tommen with your own eyes, if you doubt me. A blind man could see it. What does Stannis offer you? Vengeance? Vengeance for my sons and yours? For your husbands and your fathers and your brothers? Vengeance for your murdered lord? Your murdered king? Your butchered princess? Vengeance!
Yes, piped a girl's voice, thin and high.
It belonged to the half-grown child with the blonde eyebrows and the long green braid.
They killed Lord Eddard and Lady Caitling and King Rob, she said. He was our king. He was brave and good, and the Freys murdered him. If Lord Stannis will avenge him, we should join Lord Stannis.
Manderley pulled her close.
Willer, every time you open your mouth, you make me want to send you to the Silent Sisters.
I only said...
We heard what you said, said the older girl, her sister.
A child's foolishness.
Speak no ill of our friends of Frey. One of them will be your lord and husband soon.
No, the girl declared, shaking her head.
I won't ever. They killed the king.
Lord Wyman flushed.
You will. When the appointed day arrives, you will speak your wedding vows, else you will join the Silent Sisters and never speak again.
The poor girl looked stricken.
Grandfather, please.
Hush, child, said Lady Leona. You heard your lord grandfather. Hush. You know nothing.
I know about the promise, insisted the girl. Maester Theomore, tell them. 1,000 years before the conquest, a promise was made, and oaths were sworn in the wolf's den before the old gods and the new. When we were sore beset and friendless, hounded from our homes and in peril of our lives, the wolves took us in, and nourished us and protected us against our enemies. The city is built upon the land they gave us. In return, we swore that we should always be their men, Stark men.
The maester fingered the chain about his neck. Solemn was sworn to the Starks of Winterfell, aye, but Winterfell has fallen, and House Stark has been extinguished.
That's because they killed them all.
Another Frey spoke up.
Lord Wyman, if I may.
Wyman Manderley gave him a nod.
Rhaegar, oh, we're always pleased to hear your noble counsel.
Rhaegar Frey acknowledged the compliment with a bow. He was 30, or nigh unto, round-shouldered and kettle-bellied, but richly dressed in a doublet of soft grey lamb's wool trimmed in cloth of silver. His cloak was cloth of silver, too, lined with vair, and clasped to the collar with a brooch in the shape of the Twin Towers.
"Lady Wyler," he said to the girl with the green braid, "loyalty is a virtue. I hope you will be as loyal to Little Order when you are joined in wedlock. As to the Starks, that house is extinguished only in the male line. Lord Eddard's sons are dead, but his daughters live, and the younger girl is coming north to wed brave Ramsay Bolton."
"Ramsay Snow?"
Wyler Manderley threw back.
"Oh, have it as you will. By any name he shall soon be wed to Arya Stark. If you would keep faith with your promise, give him your allegiance, for he shall be your lord of Winterfell."
"He won't ever be my lord. He made Lady Hornwood marry him, then shut her in a dungeon, and made her eat her fingers."
A murmur of assent swept through the merman's court.
"The maid tells it true,"
declared a stocky man in white and purple, whose cloak was fastened with a pair of cross bronze keys.
"Roose Bolton's cold and cunning, aye, but a man can deal with Roose. We've all known worse, but this bastard son of his, they say he's mad and cruel, a monster."
"They say,"
Rhaegar Frey sported a silky beard and a sardonic smile. "His enemies say, aye, but it was the young wolf who was the monster. More beast than boy, that boy, puffed up with pride and bloodlust.
And he was faithless, as my lord grandfather learned to his sorrow."
He spread his hands.
"I do not fault White Harbor for supporting him. My grandsire made the same grievous mistake. In all the young wolves' battles, White Harbor and the twins fought side by side, beneath his banners. Robb Stark betrayed us all. He abandoned the north to the cruel mercies of the Iron Men to carve out a fairer kingdom for himself along the Trident. Then he abandoned the River Lords, who had risked much and more for him, breaking his marriage pact with my grandfather to wed the first western wench who caught his eye. The young wolf? Oh, he was a vile dog, and died like one.
The merman's court had grown still. Davis could feel the chill in the air. Lord Wyman was looking down at Rhaegar as if he were a roach in need of a hard heel. Yet then, abruptly, he gave a ponderous nod that set his chins to wobbling.
"A dug, aye. He brought us only grief and death. A vile dog indeed. Say on."
Rhaegar Frey went on.
"Grief and death, aye. And this onion lord will bring you more with his talk of vengeance. Open your eyes, as my lord grandsire did. The war of the five kings is all but done. Tommen is our king, our only king. We must help him bind up the wounds of this sad war. As Robert's true-born son, the heir of Stag and Lion, the Iron Throne is his by rights."
"Wise words and true," said Lord Wyman Manderley.
"They won't,"
Wyler Manderley stamped her foot.
"Be quiet, wretched child," scolded Lady Leona. "Young girls should be an ornament to the eye, not an ache in the ear."
She seized the girl by her braid and pulled her, squealing, from the hall. "There went my only friend in this hall," thought Davos.
"Wyler has always been a wilful child," her sister said, by way of apology. "I fear she will make a wilful wife."
Rhaegar shrugged.
"Marriage will soften her, I have no doubt. A firm hand and a quiet word. If not, there are the Silent Sisters," Lord Wyman shifted in his seat. "As for you, Onion Knight, I've heard sufficient treason for one day. You would have me risk my city for a false king and a false god. You would have me sacrifice my only living son, so Stannis Baratheon can plant his puckered ass upon a throne to which he has no right?
I will not do it. Not for you, not for your lord, not for any man."
The Lord of White Harbor pushed himself to his feet. The effort brought a red flush to his neck.
"You are still a smuggler, sir, come to steal my gold and blood. You would take my son's head. I think I shall take yours instead. Guards, seize this man."
Before Davos could even think to move, he was surrounded by silver tritons.
"My lord," he said, "I am an envoy."
"Are you?
You came sneaking into my city like a smuggler. I see you are no lord, no knight, no envoy, only a thief and a spy, a peddler of lies and treasons. I should tear your tongue out with hot pincers and deliver you to the dread fort to be fleed. But the mother is merciful, and so am I."
He beckoned to Sir Marlon.
"Cousin, take this creature to the wolf's den, and cut off his head and hands. I want them brought to me before I sup. I shall not be able to eat a bite until I see this smuggler's head upon a spike, with an onion shoved between his lying teeth."
Reek. They gave him a horse and a banner, a soft woolen doublet, and a warm fur cloak, and set him loose. For once he did not stink.
"Come back with that castle," said Damon Dancefor-me, as he helped Reek climb shaking into the saddle. "Or keep going and see how far you get before we catch you." "He'd like that, he would."
Grinning, Damon gave the horse a lick across the rump with his whip, and the old stot whinnied and lurched into motion. Reek did not dare to look back for fear that Damon and Yellow Dick and Grunt and the rest were coming after him. That all of this was just another of Lord Ramsay's japes, some cruel test to see what he would do if they gave him a horse and set him free.
"Do they think that I will run?"
The stud they had given him was a wretched thing, knock-kneed and half-starved. He could never hope to outdistance the fine horses that Lord Ramsay and his hunters would be riding. And Ramsay loved nothing more than to set his girls baying on the trail of some fresh prey. Besides, where would he run to? Behind him were the camps crowded with Dreadfort men, and those the Risewells had brought from the Rills, with the Barriton hosts between them.
South of Moat Cailin, another army was coming up the causeway, an army of Boltons and Preys, marching beneath the banners of the Dreadfort. East of the road lay a bleak and barren shore, and a cold salt sea. To the west, the swamps and bogs of the Neck, infested with serpents, lizard-lions, and bug-devils with their poisoned arrows. He would not run. He could not run.
"I will deliver him the castle. I will. I must."
It was a grey day, damp and misty. The wind was from the south, moist as a kiss. The ruins of Moat Cailin were visible in the distance, threaded through with wisps of morning mist. His horse moved toward them at a walk, her hooves making faint, wet, squelching sounds as they pulled free of the grey-green muck.
"I have come this way before."
It was a dangerous sort, and he regretted it at once.
"No," he said, "no, that was some other man. That was before you knew your name."
His name was Reek. He had to remember that.
"Reek, Reek, it rhymes with leek."
When that other man had come this way, an army had followed close behind him, the great hosts of the north riding to war beneath the grey and white banners of House Stark. Reek rode alone, clutching a peace banner on a pinewood staff. When that other man had come this way, he had been mounted on a courser, swift and spirited. Reek rode a broken-down stut, all skin and bone and ribs, and he rode her slowly for fear he might fall off. The other man had been a good rider, but Reek was uneasy on horseback. It had been so long. He was no rider. He was not even a man. He was Lord Ramsay's creature, lower than a dog, a worm in human skin. "You will pretend to be a prince," Lord Ramsay told him last night, as Reek was soaking in a tub of scalding water. "But we know the truth. You're Reek. You'll always be Reek, no matter how sweet you smell. Your nose may lie to you. Remember your name. Remember who you are." "Reek," he said, "you're Reek. Do this little thing for me, and you can be my dog and eat meat every day," Lord Ramsay promised. "You will be tempted to betray me, to run or fight or join our foes. No, quiet. I'll not hear you deny it. Lie to me and I'll take your tongue. A man would turn against me in your place, but we know what you are, don't we? Betray me if you want, it makes no matter, but count your fingers first and know the cost." Reek knew the cost. 7, he thought. 7 fingers. A man can make do with 7 fingers. 7 is a sacred number. He remembered how much it had hurt when Lord Ramsay had commanded Skinner to lay his ring finger bare. The air was wet and heavy, and shallow pools of water dotted the ground. Reek picked his way between them carefully, following the remnants of the log and plank road that Rob Stark's vanguard had laid down across the soft ground to speed the passage of his host. Where once a mighty curtain wall had stood, only scattered stones remained. Blocks of black basalt, so large it must have taken 100 men to hoist them into place. Some had sunk so deep into the bog that only a corner showed. Others lay strewn about like some guard's abandoned toys, cracked and crumbling, spotted with lichen. Last night's rain had left the huge stones wet and glistening, and the morning sunlight made them look as if they were coated in some fine black oil. Beyond stood the towers. The drunkard's tower leaned as if it were about to collapse, just as it had for 500 years. The children's tower thrust into the sky as straight as a spear, but its shattered top was open to the wind and rain. The gatehouse tower, squat and wide, was the largest of the three, slimy with moss, a gnarled tree growing sideways from the stones of its north side.
fragments of broken walls still standing to the east and west. The Karstarks took the Drunkard's Tower, and the Umbers the Children's Tower, he recalled. Rob claimed the Gatehouse Tower for his own. If he closed his eyes, he could see the banners in his mind's eye snapping bravely in a brisk north wind. All gone now, all fallen. The wind on his cheeks was blowing from the south, and the only banners flying above the remains of Moat Cailin displayed a golden kraken on a field of black. He was being watched. He could feel the eyes. When he looked up, he caught a glimpse of pale faces peering from behind the battlements of the Gatehouse Tower, and through the broken masonry that crowned the Children's Tower, where legend said the Children of the Forest had once called down the Hammer of the Waters to break the lands of Westeros in two. The only dry road through the neck was the causeway, and the towers of Moat Cailin plugged its northern end like a cork in a bottle. The road was narrow, the ruins so positioned that any enemy coming up from the south must pass beneath and between them. To assault any of the three towers, an attacker must expose his back to arrows from the other two. Whilst climbing damp stone walls, festooned with streamers of slimy white ghost skin. The swampy ground beyond the causeway was impassable, an endless morass of suckholes, quicksands, and glistening green swards that looked solid to the unwary eye, but turned to water the instant you trod upon them. The whole of it infested with venomous serpents and poisonous flowers and monstrous lizard lions with teeth like daggers. Just as dangerous were its people, seldom seen but always lurking, the swamp dwellers, the frog eaters, the mud men, fen and reed, peat and bugs, cray and quag, green good and blackmire. Those were the sorts of names they gave themselves. The Arnborn called them all bug devils. Reek passed the rotted carcass of a horse, an arrow jutting from his neck. A long white snake slithered into its empty eye socket at his approach. Behind the horse he spied the rider, or what remained of him. The crows had stripped the flesh from the man's face, and a feral dog had burrowed beneath his mail to get at his entrails. Further on, another corpse had sunk so deep into the muck that only his face and fingers showed. Closer to the towers, corpses littered the ground on every side. Blood blooms had sprouted from their gaping wounds, pale flowers with petals plump and moist as a woman's lips.
"The garrison will never know me."
Some might recall the boy he'd been before he learned his name, but Reek would be a stranger to them. It had been a long while since he last looked into a glass, but he knew how old he must appear. His hair had turned white, much of it had fallen out, and what was left was stiff and dry as straw. The dungeons had left him weak as an old woman, and so thin a strong wind could knock him down. In his hands, Ramsay had given him gloves, fine gloves of black leather, soft and supple, stuffed with wool to conceal his missing fingers. But if anyone looked closely, he would see that three of his fingers did not bend.
"No closer," a voice rang out. "What do you want?"
Words, he spurred the stud onward, waving the peace banner so they could not fail to see it.
"I come unarmed."
There was no reply. Inside the walls, he knew, the iron men were discussing whether to admit him or fill his chest with arrows.
"It makes no matter.
A quick death here would be 100 times better than returning to Lord Ramsay as a failure." Then the gatehouse doors flung open.
"Quickly!"
Reek was turning toward the sound when the arrow struck. It came from somewhere to his right, where broken chunks of the curtain wall lay half-submerged beneath the bug. The shaft tore through the folds of his banner and hung spent, the point a bare foot from his face. It startled him so badly that he dropped the peace banner and tumbled from his saddle.
"Inside!" the voice shouted. "Hurry, fool, hurry!"
Reek scrambled up the steps on hands and knees as another arrow fluttered over his head. Someone seized him and dragged him inside, and he heard the door crash shut behind him. He was pulled to his feet and shoved against a wall. Then a knife was at his throat, a bearded face so close to his that he could count the man's nose hairs.
"Who are you? What's your purpose here? Quick now, or I'll do you the same as him."
The guard jerked his head towards a body rotting on the floor beside the door, its flesh green and crawling with maggots.
"I am Ironborn," Reek answered, lying. The boy he'd been before had been Ironborn, true enough, but Reek had come into this world in the dungeons of the Dreadfort. "Look at my face. I'm Lord Balin's son, your prince."
He would have said the name, but somehow the words caught in his throat.
"Reek, I'm Reek. It rhymes with squeak."
He had to forget that for a little while, though. No man would ever yield to a creature such as Reek, no matter how desperate his situation. He must pretend to be a prince again. His captor stared at his face, squinting, his mouth twisted in suspicion. His teeth were brown, and his breath stank of ale and onion.
"Lord Balin's sons were killed."
"My brothers, not me. Lord Ramsay took me captive after Winterfell. He sent me here to treat with you. Do you command here?"
"Me?"
The man lowered his knife and took a step backwards, almost stumbling over the corpse.
"Not me, my lord."
His mail was rusted, his leathers rotting. On the back of one hand, an open sore wept blood.
"Ralph Kenny, as they command," the captain said. "I'm on the door, is all."
"And who is this?"
Reek gave the corpse a kick. The guard stared at the dead man as if seeing him for the first time.
"Him? He drank the water. I had to cut his throat for him to stop his screaming. Bad belly. You can't drink the water. That's why we got the ale."
The guard rubbed his face, his eyes red and inflamed.
"We used to drag the dead down into the cellars. All the vaults are flooded down there. No one wants to take the trouble now, so we just leave them where they fall."
"The cellar is a better place for them. Give them to the water, to the drowned god."
The man laughed.
"No gods down there, my lord. Only rats and water snakes. White things, thick as your leg. Sometimes they slither up the steps and bite you in your sleep."
Reek remembered the dungeons underneath the Dreadfort, the rat squirming between his teeth, the taste of warm blood on his lips.
"If I fail, Ramsay will send me back to that, but first he'll flay the skin from another finger." "How many of the garrison are left?"
"Some," said the Iron Man. "I don't know. Fewer than we was before. Some in the Drunken's Tower, too, I think. Not the Children's Tower. Dagon Cod went over there a few days back. Only two men left alive, he said, and they was eating on the dead ones. He'd kill them both, if you can believe that."
"Moat Cailin has fallen," Reek realized then. "Only no one has seen fit to tell them."
He rubbed his mouth to hide his broken teeth and said,
"I need to speak with your commander."
"Kenning?" The guard seemed confused. "He don't have much to say these days. He's dying. Might be he's dead. I haven't seen him since. Oh, I don't remember when."
"Where is he? Take me to him."
"Who will keep the door, then?"
"Him."
Reek gave the corpse a kick. That made the man laugh.
"Aye, why not? Come with me, then."
He pulled a torch down from a wall sconce and waved it till it blazed up bright and hot.
"This way."
The guard led him through a door and up a spiral stair, the torchlight glimmering off black stone walls as they climbed. The chamber at the top of the steps was dark, smoky, and oppressively hot. A ragged skin had been hung across the narrow window to keep the damp out, and a slab of peat smoldered in a brazier. The smell in the room was foul, a miasma of mould and piss and night soil, of smoke and sickness. Soiled rushes covered the floor, whilst a heap of straw in the corner passed for a bed. Ralph Kenning lay shivering beneath a mountain of furs. His arms were stacked beside him, sword and axe, mail hauberk, iron war helm. His shield bore the storm guard's cloudy hand, lightning crackling from his fingers down to a raging sea. But the paint was discolored and peeling, the wood beneath starting to rot. Ralph was rotting, too. Beneath the furs he was naked and feverish, his pale, puffy flesh covered with weeping sores and scabs. His head was misshapen, one cheek grotesquely swollen, his neck so engorged with blood that it threatened to swallow his face. The arm on that same side was big as a log and crawling with white worms. No one had bathed him or shaved him for many days, from the look of him. One eye wept pus, and his beard was crusty with dried vomit.
"What happened to him?"
asked Reek.
"He was on the parapets, and some bug devil loosed an arrow at him. It was only a graze, but they poison their shafts, smear the points with shit and worse things. We poured boiling wine into the wound, but it made no difference."
"I cannot treat with this thing."
"Kill him," Reek told the guard. "His wits are gone. He's full of blood and worms."
The man gaped at him.
"The captain put him in command."
"You'd put a dying horse down."
"What horse? I never had no horse."
"I did."
The memory came back in a rush. Smiler's screams had sounded almost human. His mane afire, he had reared up and his hind legs, blind with pain, lashing out with his hooves.
"No, no, not mine. He was not mine. Reek never had a horse."
"I will kill him for you."
Reek snatched up Ralph Kenning's sword, where it leaned against his shield. He still had fingers enough to clasp the hilt. When he laid the edge of the blade against the swollen throat of the creature on the straw, the skin split open in a gout of black blood and yellow pus. Kenning jerked violently, then lay still. An awful stench filled the room. Reek bolted for the steps. The air was damp and cold, but much cleaner by comparison. The Iron Man stumbled out after him, white-faced and struggling not to retch. Reek grasped him by the arm.
"Who was second in command? Where are the rest of the men?"
"Up on the battlements or in the hall, sleeping, drinking. I'll take you if you like."
"Do it now."
Ramsay had only given him a day. The hall was dark stone, high-ceilinged and draughty, full of drifting smoke, its stone walls spotted by huge patches of pale lichen. A peat fire burned low in a hearth blackened by the hotter blazes of years past. A massive table of carved stone filled the chamber, as it had for centuries.
"There was where I sat the last time I was here," he remembered. "Rob was at the head of the table, with the great John to his right, and Roos Bolden on his left. The Glover sat next to Helm and Tallheart. Carstock and his sons were across from them."
Two dozen Ironborn sat drinking at the table. A few looked at him with dull, flat eyes when he entered. The rest ignored him. All the men were strangers to him. Several wore cloaks fastened by brooches in the shape of silver codfish. The cods were not well regarded in the Iron Islands. The men were said to be thieves and cowards, the women wantons who bedded with their own fathers and brothers. It did not surprise him that his uncle had chosen to leave these men behind when the Iron Fleet went home.
"This will make my task that much easier."
"Ralph Kenning is dead," he said. "Who commands here?"
The drinkers stared at him blankly. One laughed, another spat. Finally, one of the cods said,
"Who asks?"
"Lord Balin's son. Reek, my name is Reek. It rhymes with cheek. I am here at the command of Ramsay Bolton, Lord of the Hornwood, and heir to the Dreadfort, who captured me at Winterfell. His host is north of you, his father's to the south. but Lord Ramsay is prepared to be merciful if you yield Moat Cailin to him before the sun goes down.'